the Secretary General of NATO at the White House.
They had a working lunch, but before that lunch, the two men had a very lengthy appearance in the Oval Office where both of them answered a range of questions.
An update from the front lines in Russia's war on Ukraine.
Ultimately, I think what Russia wants is control over Ukraine politically.
And why a night on the town might soon cost more.
President Trump threatened a 200% tariff on wine, champagne, and spirits that are brought in to this country from Europe.
Today is Friday, March 14th. And this is VOA's International Edition.
I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. On Thursday, Mark Rutte, Secretary General of NATO, visited U.S. President Donald Trump in the White House. I'm joined by VOA's senior White House correspondent, Anita Powell, for the details.
They had a working lunch, but before that lunch, the two men had a very lengthy appearance in the Oval Office where both of them answered a range of questions. And these ranged from the immediate talks about the potential for a 30-day ceasefire in Ukraine and where that stands, and also the awkward, such as when Trump brought up his intention to gain dominance over Greenland, which, of course, as a holding of Denmark, makes Greenland something of a NATO member. And so that would be very awkward for the Secretary General of NATO when, you know, one NATO member is expressing a desire to take over another NATO member. That raises all sorts of questions. So he kind of extricated himself from that delicate question very, very skillfully. But it was a wide-ranging event where he talked about all sorts of things. But really, the emphasis is on, and all eyes are on, what's going on right now in Moscow, in Washington, and also in Kyiv, where we've heard President Zelensky say that Ukraine is amenable to a 30-day ceasefire. They're still stressing the need for security guarantees. Then we heard this morning from President Putin of Russia that, you know, it's a glass half empty, glass half full situation. You could look at his response either way, because he said we accept this in principle, but there's still a lot we need to work out and we need to talk to Donald Trump is basically what he said. So I didn't feel like that was either a hard yes or a hard no. And it was a very kind of middling maybe, really. And when something is this important, that could really go either way. Of course, the key thing for Putin, one of the key things for Putin, is that there be no European peacekeepers on Ukrainian soil. And this is, of course, what Europe is right now talking about doing. So this is a very delicate situation. And, you know, it rests on these variables and these three individuals, especially those three being Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin, and Volodymyr Zelensky.
So, Anita, is there any idea when Putin and Trump or Russian authorities and American authorities might meet?
So right now we have President Trump's special envoy for the Middle East. I know that's confusing, but he's a special envoy for the Middle East. He's in Moscow meeting with Russian officials. But Putin said very clearly that he wants to talk to Donald Trump. And Trump said that he's interested in meeting. And he said previously that he would be willing to meet President Putin in Saudi Arabia. And about a week and a half ago, he said that would be in a matter of 6 weeks or so. So we're looking for this one-on-one meeting between these two figures in Saudi Arabia at some point in the future. And that is that's a key next step in these negotiations. The other thing we're also looking for that was we thought might happen this week and so far has not happened is President Zelensky returning to Washington to ink this minerals deal. And when I say minerals deal, that makes it sound a lot harder than it is. It's still a very notional, vague minerals deal. It's an agreement to have a future agreement to explore the possibility of, you know, you see when you add all of these words to it, it gets more and more nebulous. But that is kind of the as concrete as this agreement is right now. But this, as Trump has said, is a key first step to securing continued U.S. support of Ukraine. We've also just seen the U.S. has reinitiated cooperation with Ukraine on intelligence and military planning, and that was greeted with relief from Ukrainian troops on the ground. We've heard that out of Ukraine. But it's a very volatile situation especially considering how gruesome and brutal this conflict is. And, you know, Trump has been very clear that that is his main intention, to stop the killing, stop the dying, as he says. But, I mean, it all kind of hangs in the balance. And the next move by any of these three principals really, really matters.
That's VOA's senior White House correspondent, Anita Powell. Anita, thanks for the update.
My pleasure.
On Thursday, Russian President Vladimir Putin said that Moscow agrees in principle with U.S. proposals for a ceasefire in Ukraine, but details still need to be sorted out and that any truce would have to deal with the root causes of the conflict. Putin said he may call President Trump to discuss the issue, which the U.S. president said he'd be open to. And Trump said he sees good signals coming out of Russia, but offered guarded optimism about Putin's statement. My colleagues Lori London and Scott Walterman spoke with Jennifer Kavanaugh, a senior fellow and director of military analysis at Defense Priorities.
Thank you for being able to talk to us about this today.
Thank you for having me.
So the first messaging from Moscow was, there's nothing in this ceasefire for us. And that became, we agree sort of to the ceasefire, but there's a lot of conditions that have to be met. What does that say about where we are in the process?
One thing that we've known since the beginning is that Putin really has the upper hand over Ukraine when it comes to these negotiations, because they are winning on the battlefield right now. So Putin has very little incentive to settle unless he's getting the terms that he wants. Ukraine is on the back foot. We've seen Russia reclaim most of the territory that Ukraine was holding in Kursk. Ukraine suffered another setback due to the U.S. pause in military aid. So Putin really has a significant advantage here and has no incentive to stop pressing until he thinks he's going to get a deal that he likes.
Right. And the senior aide to Russian President Vladimir Putin said that the ceasefire would basically allow Ukrainian forces to regroup. But wouldn't it be both sides that would be able to kind of do that?
Of course, both sides would be able to regroup in any type of ceasefire, but Ukraine needs that regrouping more. Russia, although they have suffered tremendous military losses and are relying on North Korean forces to fight in Kursk and have burned through several armies worth of materiel at this point, still has the upper hand on the battlefield and can keep going for much longer, just because it is so much bigger, it has so many more people, and its industrial capacity is just so many times greater than Ukraine's. So while a ceasefire would allow both parties to rest and refit and rebuild their militaries a little bit, 30 days isn't that much, but it gives you a little bit of time. Ukraine just needs it much more. Their lines are on the verge of collapse.
What would Russia want? I mean, what would be their ask? We understand that they've made some asks, but we don't know what they are.
You know, in the short term, they might try to attach conditions to the 30-day ceasefire, things to help them consolidate their gains, like no U.S. military aid during the 30-day period to limit the amount that Ukraine is able to rebuild its stocks and its arsenal. They might ask, and I think they have asked, for formal recognition of their sovereignty over the territories that they've claimed in Ukraine. That would give them, you know, a feeling of insurance that those territories now are under their domain, and a feeling of finality in terms of the battle over those specific pieces of land. So those are sort of near-term things. If they're willing to accept a 30-day ceasefire at all, there's been some indications from Putin that he'd really prefer to keep pressing on the battlefield until a final deal is settled. In effect, using the military leverage that he has to keep pressing until he gets the best possible final deal with no sort of ceasefire that would give Ukraine time to take back even a little bit of that leverage.
Right. And Ukraine has said that, you know, well, obviously Ukraine needed to do this to show that it wasn't an obstacle to peace. But ultimately, it's saying what Russia wants, what it wants. What does Russia want? What is its end game? Do we know?
I mean, ultimately, I think what Russia wants is control over Ukraine politically. And that could come in a number of forms. They're not going to be able to conquer all of Ukraine, which was the start goal of their invasion in 2022. But I think what they're hoping for is a Ukraine that is neutral, that is not attached to NATO, that has no security guarantees, and that it has as small a military force as possible. I think Russia would also like to see Zelensky gone and a political leader in Kyiv who is favorable to Russia or that they can control. That would be their ultimate goal. Now, I don't think that the Trump administration sees that as something that's in U.S. interests. That outcome is not in U.S. interests. So I don't think they'll get all of that. But because they do have this military advantage, Putin has an incentive to keep pressing to get as much of those maximalist demands as possible.
So you think that they're just going to probably keep fighting until if and when they can get any kind of negotiation going?
I mean, it's possible. It's also possible that right now they're playing hardball and that they are willing to negotiate some type of interim ceasefire, but that they don't want to do that with Witkoff, or that they don't feel that right now the terms that they've been given are sufficient, or that they want to wait until they've fully claimed the territory in Kursk. So there's a number of things that could happen. It also depends a little bit on how the Trump administration plays this. You know, they do have leverage over Russia and a number of different types. One is a willingness to discuss some of the issues that Russia sees as the core of this conflict, like the post-U.S. role in Europe's security architecture. They could push on sanctions. They haven't worked that well, but there are still some things the U.S. could do to put economic pressure. Or they could say, well, if you don't want to negotiate, we will increase military aid to Ukraine. So there's a couple of things the Trump administration could do to try to press Moscow. The question is, well, whether or not they're willing to do that. But I do think one thing we're seeing here is how tough these negotiations will be. I think there was hope that they would be quick and easy, and I think that is quickly becoming a false hope. It's apparent that this will take time.
It sounds like what you just said, there are options for the White House.
There are options. They obviously have more leverage over Kyiv because it's the weaker party and it's very dependent on the United States. But the United States does have leverage over Russia. And I think, you know, if I were advising the negotiating team, I would try to really stress that point, that the U.S. is the player here that has the most leverage and should negotiate from a position of strength, not weakness.
Jennifer, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We've been hearing about the diplomatic efforts to stop the fighting in Ukraine. But even as the talks continue, so does the war. Getting us caught up on the military developments is Angelica Evans, an analyst with the Institute for the Study of War.
So we've heard a lot about Kursk in the last few days. The Russians are, of course, making significant gains there and getting ready to push the Ukrainians out of the remaining positions that they have in Kursk. But elsewhere along the battlefield, we're seeing a really interesting shift in what the narrative has been over the last few years. The Russians seem to really be running out of gas and running out of steam in some of their priority areas of the front line. So the Russians kind of announced intentions to conduct some big attacks in Kharkiv and in Donetsk. Of course, we hear a lot about Russian activity in Donetsk, particularly near Pokrovsk, and the possibility of a Russian attack on Ukraine's fortress belt near a settlement called Kostantinivka. There's been a lot of Russian efforts to intensify there, but the Russians don't really seem to be making significant gains. And in fact, near Pokrovsk and Turets in particular, the Ukrainians really seem to be leveraging improved ground operations with drone operations to really challenge the tactical initiative in some of those areas. And we've seen several weeks of slow Ukrainian gains, particularly in the Pokrovsk and Turets directions.
So going back to Kursk and the Russian advances there encircling the Ukrainians, what happened? How did the Ukrainians lose their footing?
So the Russians have spent essentially the last 7 months since the Ukrainians attacked into Kursk really building up and preparing the force grouping that they intended to use to retake that territory. So this has been a long-term effort that they've been working on for a long time. They finally kind of built this grouping of 78,000 Russian and North Korean troops in this area. They've been slowly chipping away at the Ukrainian salient in Kursk, but really in the last week, you know, we've seen this intensified and really rapid series of Russian advances to retake the remainder of the salient. This is, of course, kind of coincided with reports of the U.S. cutting intel sharing to Ukraine. We haven't seen any direct causation in what's happened with the salient over the last few weeks in the cutting of U.S. intel sharing. But there is a really interesting temporal correlation that we're seeing happening here. You know, I think there's a question of maybe the Russians just seeing their moment, right, and having their own understanding of what the cutting of U.S. intel could do to Ukraine and even to Ukrainian morale in the salient. So we've seen really intensified Russian efforts to get rid of Ukrainians in Kursk over the last week or so.
Well, that brings up my next question, is the pause in military aid and intelligence aid to Ukraine. What are the effects of that on the battlefield? You mentioned intelligence. What about military aid?
Yeah, so we have had some reports that the pause affected roughly 3 shipments, no estimate in the size. But, you know, the pause was short enough that we really didn't start to see the beginning of how it could impact battlefield activity for the aid. For intel sharing, you know, we started seeing reports about Ukrainians not being able to use some of the long-range strike systems that we provided them to the best of their ability, right? So the Patriot air defense systems that we provide for the Ukrainians, as well as the HIMARS long-range strike systems that they're able to use, including in Kursk, to support their operations. It seems like the range that they were able to strike with those systems was significantly degraded as a result of cutting intel sharing.
Angelica Evans is an analyst with the Institute for the Study of War. Ms. Evans, thanks for your time. Thanks for your analysis on this.
Thank you so much.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world.
The war in Sudan has created the most devastating and largest humanitarian crisis to date. That's according to the head of UNICEF, Catherine Russell. More than 30 million people, 16 million of whom are children, need aid, Russell told the UN Security Council on Thursday. An estimated 1.3 million children live where famine is rampant, with more than 770,000 children expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition in 2025. According to Russell, many of them will die without aid.
On Thursday, U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent announced sanctions on Iran's oil minister, Mohsen Paknejad, along with several Hong Kong-flagged ships, which are said to be a part of a shadow fleet helping to disguise Iranian oil shipments. Bessent said in a statement, the Iranian regime continues to use the proceeds from the nation's vast oil resources to advance its narrow, alarming self-interests at the expense of the Iranian people. The sanctions follow U.S. President Donald Trump's efforts to apply a maximum pressure policy in February, seeking to drive Iran's oil exports to zero to neutralize its ability to fund militant groups and prevent it from obtaining a nuclear weapon. Iran maintains its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes.
A looming government shutdown has U.S. lawmakers scrambling to pass a short-term continuing resolution to keep the government funded past March 14th. As an appropriations bill, it needs to reach at least 60 votes in the Senate to pass, which leaves Republicans relying on at least 8 Democrats to vote for the bill in order to get it to Trump's desk for signing. Republican Senate Majority Leader John Thune on Thursday said Democrats need to decide if they are going to support funding legislation that came over from the House or if they're going to shut down the government. So far, it's looking like they plan to shut it down. Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says the Senate should pass an earlier version of the continuing resolution that Democrats were involved in negotiating. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strope. In economic news Thursday, trade tariffs and why a glass of wine with dinner or a night at the local pub might cost more. I'm joined by VOA's White House correspondent Carolyn Pursuti for an update. So tariffs continue to be the talk surrounding U.S. policy with respect to Canada, Mexico, the EU, and China. And it's been on again, off again, back on again. Parts have been rescinded. What is the latest as far as tariffs are concerned? And let's start with Canada. Where does the U.S. and Canada stand as of now?
You know what? You're right, Alexis. It has been on again and off again. And it's very hard to keep track what is being rescinded and what is a counter tariff and what is a new tariff. It's very difficult. But as for Canada, that has certainly taken front center in our information that we're getting from the White House. The U.S. imposed a 25% tariff on Canadian metals. And then they decided they would hold back on the other tariffs. So the administration is saying we'll decide in April on lumber, dairy products, and cars. So then Canada responded and they said, we're going to put some tariffs on your electricity exports to your northern states. And that's what Canada threatened earlier this week, and then they withdrew those tariffs. But they are keeping tariffs on $21 billion worth of American goods.
the European Union also in the crosshairs of U.S. Tariffs. Now, how is the U.S. responding to those? And then in turn, how is the U.S. responding to the EU's response?
Absolutely. So the European Union put a 50% tariff on U.S. whiskey when the United States first started talking tariffs on the European Union. And so then, just today, President Trump threatened a 200% tariff on wine, champagne, and spirits that are brought in to this country from Europe. So there is that tit for tat that keeps on going on and on and on and on. And so in the Oval Office today, the president said, quote, "We've been ripped off for years and we're not going to be ripped off anymore by talking about Europe." So again, he all this is in the crosshairs of you know, this trade war that a lot of analysts call it. They say they don't see an end in sight. They say both countries lose because what happens is you have this war and you just keep digging in and these tariffs get higher and higher and higher. So when does it end? Nobody really knows.
And Mexico also facing U.S. tariffs. And Mexico seems to be a bit of an outlier in this, as there seems to be some exemptions from Mexico as far as trade goes. Now, what products still apply for tariffs and which ones have been exempted?
It certainly is an outlier, like you say, for a couple reasons. You know, in President Trump's first term, three countries had signed the North American Free Trade Act, and that was Mexico and Canada and United States. So once that became known, the United States said, okay, we will exempt certain products. We were going to tax all of your, or to put tariffs on your agriculture products, but right now we won't. So the tariff on cars also from Mexico and from Canada was rescinded, but apparently in April, that is going to be looked at again, and the United States may be imposing those tariffs on April 2nd on those cars. Also, Mexico has become an outlier because they really haven't responded with counter tariffs for the United States. And the president says, the president of Mexico says, I'm going to wait. She says, we're going to wait until Sunday, and then we're going to figure out what our response will be. So she isn't, maybe you could say, engaging in these actions of tit for tat, or you put this counter, I'll put this tariff, I'll address it with a counter tariff. She's not engaging. She's saying, we're going to sit back, we're going to decide what we're going to do, and we're going to make that announcement Sunday. So let's see what Mexico has to say.
And last, China, what is the current tariff situation between the U.S. and China?
So at first, it was a 10% tariff on all Chinese imports. Then last week, the president doubled that to 20%. So it's 20% on everything that comes in from China. But in response, then China said, wait a second, then we're going to tax your products. And so China decided to tax all of U.S. Imports on agriculture. So that took effect just Monday. So again, it's that tariff and counter tariff that is going on in the world right now. As for the global economy, where does that end? One analyst I spoke to today said it's unpredictability that is affecting the U.S. stock market, affecting stocks worldwide on various markets globally. And he also said, you know, just the governments lose. You know, they think they're going to protect their economy, but he said it's actually putting them at a disadvantage as to the price that they can offer their customers globally. So he seems to think that it's a lose-lose proposition. But if you ask the administration here at the White House, they'll tell you this is an ultimate win for us. In the immediate future, yes, we're going to feel the pain. We're going to have to suffer some increases in prices. But President Trump says in the end, there will be success and you'll be thanking me for that. And he says we're going to be a rich country.
VOA Senior Washington Correspondent Carolyn Pursuti, thank you so much for updating us on the tariffs.
My pleasure.
And on our way out today, a correction on Wednesday's show. In the story about U.S. and DRC negotiations over mineral rights, we mistakenly refer to Kinshasa as the capital of Rwanda. Kinshasa is the capital of the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Kigali is, of course, the capital of Rwanda. We regret the error.
And that'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform. and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening.